provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenis, based on the most relevant LinkedIn posts about venture capital and CW 37 and 38. Frenis specializes in B2B market research for venture capital teams, providing landscape screenings and startup segmentations with a strong focus on the tech space. Welcome to the Deep Dive. If you are operating in M&A, private equity, or venture capital, well, the last 2 weeks on LinkedIn delivered a pretty crucial set of insights. We're not just talking about what's being funded, but really how the structure of capital itself seems to be changing. So our mission today is simple: give you a shortcut to those most actionable takeaways.
Yeah, what we're seeing is this highly focused momentum. The sources really confirm that the name of the game now is disciplined execution and, you know, measurable customer outcomes. It's all driven by a tight liquidity constrained market. So we're going to try and dissect these structural shifts impacting LPs and GPs, and then maybe look at the required new playbooks for founders who are navigating this high scrutiny environment.
Okay, let's unpack this then, starting right at the foundation: how the money actually moves. Nicole DiTommaso had this brilliant observation, saying something like 99% of people in VC interviews can't explain how money actually flows through a fund.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get you into that top 1%. What's the simplest way to understand the capital waterfall?
It really comes down to the hierarchy, you know, who gets paid first? And it's pretty non-negotiable. You've got LPs, pension funds, endowments, those types. They commit the capital, but crucially, they don't wire it all up front. The fund makes what they call capital calls over time, basically as needed for investments. And it's important to remember, while the general partners, the GTs, manage the fund itself, not the firm, actually owns the equity.
Right. And then when an exit happens, say a sale or an IPO, the proceeds come back. That's the really critical distribution moment, isn't it?
Exactly. That's when the hierarchy kicks in. When that money returns, the LPs get their capital back first, plus a preferred return, often called the hurdle rate. Only once the LPs have cleared that hurdle, meaning they've got their original investment back, plus that defined profit, only then do the GPs start earning their carry, their share of the profits.
Which is why DPI is so key.
Precisely. DPI, distribution to paid in capital, it's the ultimate metric. If LPs aren't getting that preferred return, well, the GPs don't really make money. Simple as that.
Okay, so that clarity on capital flow, that directly informs how, say, emerging managers even get off the ground. Myrtle Wallico sort of outlined the path for Fundi. It's like a tiered approach, right? Mm-hmm. You don't just start with the big institutions.
No, you definitely don't. You start where you can find speed to first close. That usually means HNWI's high net worth individuals. They're the foundation. Apparently, they make up about 57% of LPs in these new funds. Average checks around, what, $300,000? Next up, you kind of graduate to family offices. They're about 32% of LPs, bigger checks, maybe $3.8 million on average. The really large institutional players, like funds of funds, they typically wait. They only represent about 11% of LPs in a brand new fund. They often prefer to see that manager succeed first, you know, before committing to fund two or fund three.
Right. Makes sense. And this brings us to maybe the most vital recent data point: liquidity. Adam Marchik, Ruben Dominguez-Ayatbar, Mark A. Paritor, they all highlighted that Carta data from Q2 2025. It shows LPs are finally getting some liquidity back. That jump in DPI distribution to paid in capital, that's like the oxygen the market desperately needed, isn't it?
It really is. It feels like the critical inflection point we've sort of been waiting for. The percentage of funds returning capital, it jumped noticeably. And across different vintages, too, from 2017 right up to 2023. We're seeing numbers like 85% of 2017 vintage funds are now generating DPI. And even, get this, 15% of the 2023 vintage funds showed DPI after just six quarters.
Wow, that's fast for a recent vintage.
It is. And that validates the whole exit-focused strategy of VCs, right? It confirms the asset class for LPs, and maybe most importantly, it unlocks that institutional capital for the next round of commitments. The cycle starts moving again.
So, okay, the system's showing signs of maybe recovery. But that same pressure for liquidity, it's forcing VCs to make some pretty existential choices, which feeds directly into this massive polarization trend we're seeing. Alberto Onetti captured it well after that Nordic fund SNO announced it wouldn't raise a third fund.
Yeah, that was a big signal. The mid-market generalist VC seems to be in a bit of a crisis. As Magni Upman from SNO highlighted, the risk is being caught in the middle. You're, quote, too small to compete with the large firms and too large to be flexible and fast-moving. So the market's really bifurcating, splitting into two extremes. You've got these highly specialized, nimble, niche funds on one end.
Super focused.
Exactly. And then on the other end, you have the global mega funds with, you know, practically unlimited capital reach. If you're a mid-sized fund right now, you have got to define your defensible edge. and quickly.
That structural pressure, then, it translates immediately to the founder playbook. I mean, if investors are being this disciplined about their own funds, you can bet they'll be pretty brutal in diligence.
Oh, absolutely. Prashant Jain laid out this really clear investor checklist for any VC or PE deal. He stresses five non-negotiables. First, promoter pedigree and track record, basically. Who are you and have you done this before? Second, clean related party transactions, no messy internal stuff. Third, promoter exclusivity. Are they fully focused on this?
Full-time commitment.
Right. Fourth, a strong management team beyond the promoter. It can't be a one-person show. And finally, ESOP pool alignment is the whole team properly incentivized for growth.
Okay, so alignment and transparency, those are just the baselines. Now let's talk execution in maybe the most critical environment, that first meeting. Emma Rees broke down how founders just constantly waste that pivotal 30-minute pitch. It sounds like it's about being really prescriptive with time, yeah.
It's pure structure. She points out most founders lose maybe 8 to 10 minutes just on small talk or, you know, fumbling with the screen share. Then they just monologue the entire deck. Rees recommends a really strict allocation. 0 to 5 minutes, build rapport. 5 to 15 minutes, crisp pitch. 15 to 20 minutes, Q&A. And here's the crucial part. 20 to 25 minutes, lock in clear next steps and the close.
The goal isn't to demo everything.
No, the goal is the second meeting, not impressing them with every single feature slide.
Okay, but even when founders are structured, they can run into that dreaded investor ghosting issue. Paul Munch tackled that one. We know VCs are time scarce, okay, but what tactical steps can a founder actually take to stop that relationship just going silent?
Yeah, ghosting. It often happens just because VCs, well, they prefer silence over delivering bad news sometimes. Paul Mage's advice on strategic communication is pretty sharp. First, focus only on funds actively investing in your exact space. Don't waste time. Second, always, always get a warm intro. Kirtan Mehta hammered this home too, from a backed founder or someone respected.
Cold outreach is tough.
Very tough. Third, lock in clear next steps before you end any conversation. Don't leave it vague. And crucially, he says, multi-thread relationships within the firm. Don't rely on just one contact point.
Makes sense. Spreading the risk. Now, Sergey Maximenko and Chris Topman offered some pretty tough love regarding what VCs actually fund, especially at the pre-seed stage. It really sounds like the market is just done funding aspiration.
I think that's fair. Sergey Maximenko says pre-seed failure isn't usually about being too early. It's about failing to build what he calls a credibility loop. Founders need to stop, well, maybe exaggerating their traction, be explicit about what they need, and be bold. Chris Topman really reinforces this. VCs don't fund ideas, they fund proof.
A proof? Meaning what exactly?
Meaning real user evidence, measurable market demand, economics that actually demonstrates scalable revenue. The serious conversation, Topman says, it only starts after you've nailed the proof of concept and you've got your first real paying customers.
Okay, so let's say a founder manages to clear all those hurdles. They're actually negotiating around. Rob Varian argued that CEOs need to stop negotiating like an operator and start negotiating like a VC. What does adopting that investor mindset actually look like at the deal table?
Well, VCs structure deals to protect their downside while optimizing for, you know, potentially unlimited upside. And that changes the structure. Farian suggests CEOs should use things like milestone-based tranches instead of just demanding one huge check up front. This spreads the risk for the VC.
Sure, but doesn't that just shift most of the operational risk onto the founder? Or does it actually enforce that disciplined execution we talked about earlier?
I think it enforces discipline. Look, VCs obsess over predictability metrics, and CEOs need to start doing that too. Farian noted VCs are looking hard at metrics like net revenue retention, gross margin expansion, because those are the primary drivers of the really high valuation multiples, you know, above 10x. So you secure the best terms by structuring the deal around demonstrating measurable predictability.
Okay, predictability, got it. Let's talk about the elephant, or maybe the AI, dominating the sector. Valerie Noel and Riad Paulison confirm AI is the primary engine now of global VC investment. But how worried should we actually be about the bubble dynamics? Daniel Howard and Jack Selby are raising some serious flags.
The worry seems justified, mainly because the data presents this clear contradiction. Valerie Noel showed, 63% of all VC deals in North America are now AI or machine learning. Huge number. Yet, Daniel Howard reports that this record high in funding coincides with maybe half of those startups lacking a viable revenue model. He literally called it dot-com deja vu. The funding volume feels disconnected from proof of monetization.
And Jack Selby added that the geographic concentration is just compounding that risk, right?
Absolutely. 75%. 3/4 of all 2024 VC dollars are concentrated in just California, New York, and Massachusetts. Selby described this as a historic coastal AI bubble, suggesting that concentration of capital is bound to lead to inflated valuations and, frankly, overcrowded markets in those specific ecosystems.
Okay, but here's where the PE and M&A folks listening really need to pay attention, I think. Because AI isn't just about funding new startups. It seems to be fundamentally changing the calculus for private equity, too. Guillermo Flor highlighted General Catalyst's AI roll-up strategy. This feels like a whole new class of acquisition target, doesn't it?
It's potentially a complete paradigm shift, yeah. Championed by Hemant Taneja at GC. The thesis is basically that AI allows traditional service businesses, think law firms, call centers, accounting firms, to achieve SaaS-like margins. How? By applying AI agents and really transforming them from within. So General Catalyst is actually acquiring these established service firms and then transforming them into AI-native businesses that could command much higher valuation multiples.
Wow. So for PE funds, you're not just looking for the next hot software startup anymore. You're looking for these sort of operational service businesses that you can scale and transform through internal AI application. That feels genuinely disruptive.
It is, and it connects directly to the playbook needed for deep tech too, which often resists those normal SaaS metrics we talked about. Mm-hmm. Danji argued that the current VC structure actually structurally fails most innovative ideas precisely because the standard playbook just doesn't fit.
So what is the right traction metric then if your pilot takes, say, 12 to 18 months, which is pretty common in deep tech?
Anna Maria Pino had a great conversation with VC Quirin Hers that provided some clarity here. Traction in deep tech isn't really about MRR, not initially anyway. It's about how binding your conversations are. VCs look for signals like which institutions are involved, are major players actually participating, are those partners allocating dedicated budget, or are they just, you know, window shopping?
Commitment signals.
Exactly. And critically, how well does the solution actually match their future capability gaps? The technical specs, yeah, they're necessary, but Hers called them hygiene factors. The commitment signal is really everything.
And we are seeing dedicated capital trying to bridge some of these complex gaps, particularly in climate tech. Killeen O'Connor pointed to that new $300 million Valley of Death fund launched by the All Aboard Fund.
Yeah, that fund specifically targets the commercial deployment gap. It's designed to help later stage climate companies scale past that initial promise, you know, into true commercial viability. And this focus is global too. Juan Pablo Orloff highlighted that despite holding something like 40% of global biodiversity, Latin America and the Caribbean currently attract less than 1% of climate tech VC funding.
Huge mismatch.
Huge. But the region apparently offers a 5 to 10x R&D talent cost advantage, and it's positioned as a prime market for actually scaling these kinds of solutions. Big opportunity there.
Okay, finally, let's look at how VCs themselves are having to adapt their own operational models. Mm-hmm. Edeo Ressi made this pretty provocative claim. The traditional 10-year VC apprenticeship is dead and largely killed by AI.
Well, that certainly raises a huge question about the future career path in venture capital, doesn't it? Ressi argues that the kind of work that traditionally took years to master, building complex Excel models, synthesizing market research, processing deal memos, it's now automated by AI, done in minutes or hours, which means that institutional gatekeeping, it's weakening. And that's why, he argues, younger managers can now compete more directly with seasoned managing partners purely on insight and speed.
Interesting. And that automation plus the need for high-speed execution, that seems to be fueling another massive structural change, the growth of venture studios. What's the evidence that LPs are actually shifting their bets towards this model?
The data from Edeo Ressi is pretty compelling. Venture studios apparently grew from just 3% to 13% of new VC funds in only 3 years. And they raised nearly three times more money in their first year than traditional VCs, even though they often have lower targets. As Patricia Jamelska noted, the appeal seems to be that studios show LPs actual company building, real execution, which makes them an attractive, maybe de-risked model in these unpredictable markets.
And this studio model isn't just theoretical. Matthew Van Haperen detailed how it's playing out geographically, specifically with Switzerland kind of emerging as a hub.
Yeah, quietly, Switzerland seems to be becoming the health tech venture studio capital of Europe, We're seeing these really focused builders dedicated to specific verticals like longevity. You've got Maximon, Centinara Labs, Neuro and Deep Digital Health. There's Eveline, Weiss Geneva, and biotech firms like MedXL, Swiss Rockets. Peter Zwasik also confirmed this shift towards deep tech in Switzerland, emphasizing that focus on execution and defensible IP, which again is exactly what the studio model is built to provide. So yeah, we've covered a tremendous amount of ground today. The critical importance of LP liquidity and DPI getting moving again, the really high stakes execution playbooks that are now required for founders, those warning signs in the sort of coastal AI bubble, and of course, the structural evolution of the VC model itself, driven by studios and AI automation.
It seems really clear that capital isn't just scarce. It's become highly intelligent and extremely targeted. The sources all seem to confirm that clear storytelling, quantifiable traction defined by those predictability metrics, and disciplined, verifiable execution, well, they remain the strongest determinants of venture outcomes. The era of just funding ambition alone, that feels definitely over.
So here's maybe a final thought. Given that the market is polarizing into these giants and niche specialists, and the data shows older vintages generally outperform newer ones, maybe due to patient returns, what role will that shrinking mid-size generalist fund play in capturing the next wave of liquidity? Especially if AI continues to make general technical expertise, well, more of a commodity. That's the really big question I think founders and VCs stuck in the middle need to be answering right now.
If you enjoyed this episode, new episodes drop every 2 weeks. Also check out our other editions on private equity, M&A, and strategy and consulting. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. And remember to subscribe to keep getting the crucial insights you need.